Folks, welcome to Home and Away on the No Ceilings NBA podcast feed and on YouTube, wherever you're joining us. I'm your host on this week's episode. I'm Maxwell Baumbach. You can find me on Twitter at Baumboards. And I am joined by Hunter Cruz. Hunter is somebody whose work I thoroughly enjoy. And I've kind of gotten, I feel like we might have started to get into things around the same time. So I've kind of really gotten to see like you come up in this scene. So I'm a huge fan of his. Really excited to have you, Hunter. Welcome to the program.
I appreciate you guys for having me.
Yeah. So Hunter, what got you into scouting initially? And when did that sort of transpire? Like, when was it like, I like basketball, but now I'm sort of fully ingrained into this scouting and player development type of basketball fandom?
So at first, I just started writing. It was for Alabama basketball at Crimson Crossover. Mm-hmm. There, I did some like scouting stuff for like high school prospects there, and I was just like just trying to get more into just how players develop and stuff. And then that kind of progressed to where I was more active on Twitter, and then naturally you engage in stuff, and that's when I kind of came across Draft Twitter. Like Jake Rosen, I saw all the pieces like Step In, those type of people, I saw their mm-hmm. stuff. And then that kind of just progressed to me doing more basketball stuff. I think it was later that year I joined Bama Insider. It's at, you know, rivals.com. I was like, for like 5 or 6 months, I was just like writing, analyzing weekly columns on just how, just covering the game. And that's kind of when I got more into X's and O's and stuff, and just kind of progressed like with my scouting as well. Just,
yeah. So up front, because one thing that drives me nuts, I listen to podcasts, and at the very end, they're like, plug your stuff. Let's plug your stuff up front. So where can people find your work? Whether it's written, podcasts, all of it.
So right now I'm doing a lot of podcasts mm-hmm. for Locked On Women's Basketball, Locked On Podcast Network. Pretty much any team, and like any team, they have it over there. But I'm at Hunter Cruz 14 on Twitter. A lot of my stuff's over there right now. Not doing much writing, but we have this fun like preseason guide thing coming out for the WNBA, kind of like y'all did for the NBA, but it's like mm-hmm. obviously at a smaller scale, and just kind of having notes and like on our first rounders as a whole.
Awesome. So. Yes, you mentioned you kind of started with like the high school scene and things like that. I kind of got like specifically into the draft Twitter sphere actively. Like I was always like an observer of it, but never really like made an account like just to talk about basketball and things like that until like June of 2021. When did you really start to dive in the pool as far as talking about drafts?
So when I really dove in, I would probably say it was around the FIBA World Cup.
Okay.
So I'm very new into it. Just like,
yeah,
I've so always engaged. I've always engaged in the draft. I just didn't like, mm-hmm. I'm going to sit down, make a board. That's that kind of
yeah,
thing.
Yeah.
So like around that time, I was like, it was so late in the 2020 class. I was like, mm-hmm. do I just jump in right now and like try to play catch up, or do I go right into like 2021? So like one day I just sat down, had like 200 names on a Google sheet document, mm-hmm. And then kind of progressed to watching like Victor and Chet and all them in that U19, and then mm-hmm. just got more and more into it, and that led up to this past class.
Nice. Yeah, because for me it was sort of similar. It was like 2020, COVID happens, there's no sports, so it's like, well, I gotta watch something. And then like I just got into just watching games for guys in the 2020 class and what have you. So do you have any like early memories of draft fandom or like being into the draft? Because it's always like so silly, but like my like first draft memory was, I remember like getting to stay up late and watch TV during the summer when I was in like third grade and becoming enamored with this prospect that they were talking about on this draft special. And he ended up being Chris Mim, who was not very good. but like at the time I was like, oh, this is so interesting. Like these kids come out and then they get drafted and like assigned to a team. Like, was there like an early guy that you remember latching onto or like early memories of the draft? Like, how did that sort of fascination begin? Oh, sorry. I think you're muted, bud. There you go.
So, yeah, I think that was bad. Yeah. So I'm not sure who that guy you mentioned was, but
he was on the Lakers for a bit. He stunk.
Yeah, my earlier. I remember Dennis Schroeder getting drafted by the Hawks. That was one.
Okay.
And when he got drafted, I was like, who is this guy? Like,
mm-hmm.
But like, the first one I can like vividly remember was when John Collins got drafted. I remember I went to Twitter. I was like, I had like some private account and I was like, good draft pick. And like the Hawks liked it.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
I thought I was like big time at that point. Yeah. So that pick I really remember.
Mm-hmm.
And then, yeah, so just around then that time,
mm-hmm.
I didn't really have any takes though, I don't think.
Yeah, like, yeah. I think my thing was like I had way too many takes, and now like I'm embarrassed like looking back on like when I was younger, and because I'm older than you are, and now like looking back at like some of the takes I had, it's like I was not watching enough film to declaratively be like, oh yeah, this guy's gonna be a bust. Like just no reason for it, just vibes, deciding who I do and don't like.
I like Trayvon Duval though. I liked him.
Oh, I remember when he came out like just being stunned that nobody took him because like
I'm pretty sure he couldn't see out of one eye or something.
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah. Because I remember like when he came out, I was like, yeah, like he didn't have a good year at Duke, but like he's got a ton of potential. He was so good like coming out of high school because like my pre-college exposure to him was like just mixtapes basically. But I was like, oh yeah, no, like he's still really athletic and somebody's going to take him. And I like, that was one of the first guys I remember going undrafted and just being stunned that like, whoa, what happened here? This is way before your time. Are you familiar with Lenny Cook at all?
No, okay. Never heard that name.
Yeah. So I had never actually like seen him play. So this was in, I want to say it was the 2002 draft. It was like the year before LeBron. He was like this really highly touted high school player. And then like, he was like projected to be a first round pick. And like, it was kind of like a Trevon Duvall situation where like he went undrafted kind of surprisingly. And then I don't think he ever played in the NBA. And there's a documentary about him, just called Cook, like COOKE, I think is the name of it. It's fascinating. Like it is one of the best basketball documentaries I've ever seen. And it's just about like how his life unfolded after that, going pro, not being in the era where you can test the waters and go back, pre-NIL. So like you burn your college eligibility coming out of high school and then nothing.
Yeah.
But anyway, yeah, sorry, went way off the rails there. How did you start kind of dabbling in like media and content as far as the draft goes? Like, did you start writing? Was it podcasts? Like, how did you kind of start branching out?
So I first like started writing a little bit. Then after that, I didn't really do a lot for a little bit. It was just about just like being on Twitter and just watching guys.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think at that point I think I created my website around then as well, where I just wrote as well. But I haven't really done a ton of writing on the draft, I don't think, as much as I probably should have. Just a lot of Twitter stuff. Mm-hmm. Stuff like that.
Yeah. And were there like, what were some of the early lessons that you learned like as you started to get into it? Because the big thing for me was, I feel like when I first started to get into it, I really overvalued like older prospects. I think I really like the first two drafts I did, I think the biggest lesson I've learned is just don't bet against like size, playmaking, and feel. Like, were there certain things that you really liked and now you're kind of like, oh, I don't know about this, or like what have been like your big takeaways as you started to get more and more into scouting?
So at that point I probably would say I was like enamored with like the mixtape guards, I would say.
Okay.
Like, yeah, like just the guards that like you consider more on a college level, like using an Alabama example, like Javon Quinterly, like someone like that.
I was more on
like that kind of stuff, just because like I feel like if you're just watching like highlights, those are the type of guys that would just pop immediately.
Mm-hmm.
So along with that, I would say I valued probably a lot of, I really liked like just a lot of shooters. I think I valued too many sharpshooters as well when, like, they can't play defense. I just kind of, like, stuck to what they could do, and I was like, oh, this is a star. It's a star. Like, I had, like, Patrick Baldwin, like, 2 or something to begin the class.
Okay.
I was like, yeah.
Got it. I completely agree with, like, the mixed guards thing, because I think it's really easy to, like, and I feel like this is something that I always change, like, late in the process, is I feel like I lean so much more into guys that do stuff on the ball during the season. And then, because, like, during the season, it's just like, all right, this game has 5 prospects in it, so I'm just going to kind of watch the ball. And, like, you watch the game, and, like, whoever just has the ball is, like, the guy that stands out. And then when you go back and watch the game later, or you see a different game with that team, it's the guys that are doing stuff constantly. Like, when you're just watching that one guy, you get such a better feel for them. So, like, I totally relate to that. Like, I feel like that's something that I always make adjustments on my board after the draft. There are guys that, like, just don't pop. Like, if you're just watching the ball during a game, and then you watch them specifically and you just see how much value they add. Mm-hmm. The other thing I've that, like, I'm kind of, like, proud of myself for in some ways, are, like, the what I call, like, when the dust settles prospects, where it's guys like Vince Williams in last year's draft. I think ESPN had him in, like, the 90s on their board for a long time, but it was just like, I'm staying the course. Like, I like this guy. I'm going to keep him in the mix, because once everything slows down and people start to dig into that mid-major tape, like, guys like him and Ryan Rollins are going to move up. You mentioned Javon Quinterly, and he was the guy I was kind of really enamored with heading into this season, or last season rather. Really just didn't have his shot fall this past season. Being somebody that has covered, you know, the SEC in particular, but Alabama as well. Like, what do you think went wrong for Quinterly this season? And then, like, do you think he's still, like, a real prospect at this stage? Like, what would need to go right for him this time around?
He probably needs to bring the shooting back up, because, like, as a sophomore, his shooting was, like, it was, like, I think it was, like, 40%, but he also had, like,
it was Herb, really good.
Yeah, mm-hmm. So it was like Herb. He was playing off the ball a little bit more. So I would just say, like, there wasn't a lot of spacing, I would say. So, like, Javon's the type of player where, like, he's going to create a ton of rim pressure. So if he doesn't have the shooters, they kind of, like, they're going to kind of fold into him. So then he's like, okay, I'm just going to shoot. Because, like, if he drives, he's going to get that mm-hmm. kind of stuff. And I think he was just kind of, like, I don't know. It was, like, there was too many inconsistencies with the rotations, like, as well. Because, like, him and JD would, like, flip-flop who's starting.
Yeah.
Because Javon was, like, mostly, like, his role was, like, super, like, specific. Like, he was a 6th man, and that was, like, clear from, like, the start of the season.
Mm-hmm.
The year before.
Yeah. And he finished that year so strong. Like, mm-hmm. I think that's something that gets forgotten, is people are like, oh, he had, like, this down year or whatever. It's like, he was electric to close the season before this last one. It's like, that's why expectations were so high. Like, he closed on such a high note, and then this last season just kind of went how it did. But do you think that he's, like, a real prospect? Like, what range would you have him in headed into the year? Because, like, I don't think he's, like, in my top 100 or anything at this point.
Yeah, I think he's too old, probably.
Yeah, I think it's the age, and I think it's just, like, the NBA role, where, like, if you're that size and you're not going to be, like, a really determined, locked in defender too, it's like, even, like, the other stuff just doesn't really matter. Like, if it, like, you're not good enough at that stuff to really wow me, but, like, all the other things, it's just like, these kind of guys, just, it's really hard. It's really hard to stick if you're an undersized guard now. And if, especially if, like, the defense isn't there too. So, mm-hmm. Yeah. So, a big part of the reason I wanted to have you on and talk to you is because you've really started to cover the WNBA draft quite a bit, which I think is awesome. So to kind of dive into, like, I guess my, like, personal WNBA background, I'm not, like, a huge, like, follower of the WNBA, but I really enjoy it. I've gotten more into it the last couple of years because I'm in the Chicagoland area, and the Chicago Sky have been very good. But growing up, like, I had 2 older sisters and we all played basketball. So when the WNBA launched, it was, like, the biggest deal in our house. Like, we had WNBA posters up all over the place. Like, my sister was, like, really into Rebecca Lobo. I had a huge crush on Michelle Griffiths, who played for the Phoenix Mercury. Like, we all like kind of like chose a team and like got really into the WNBA. And then when they expanded to Indiana, like we all went to an Indiana Fever game as a family. Like, we made the road trip from Chicago, stayed there for a weekend so we could see a WNBA game. Like, it was a huge deal for us, like, when the WNBA really started to blossom. And then, like, as I got older, I just kind of got out of it. And then a couple years ago, I was at the gym on a treadmill running, and like, I'm just like flipping around because I need to have something like in front of me. Mm-hmm. I'm not a guy who can run outside. Like, I need to do it on a treadmill with entertainment in front of me, or else I will not run. So I threw on a WNBA game, and it was just like, whoa, like, quality of play. It was never like as bad as like misogynists will make it out to be. But like, it was just like, oh man, like, the quality of play has really, really leveled up. And I think you've touched on it, but like, there's a real dire need for expansion in some ways with the amount of talent in the league and the level of college player that will be out of the league rather quickly. But what kind of got you into following, covering the WNBA?
So I would say, like, before the pandemic, I wasn't like too into it. And I don't know, I was more of a casual follower of basketball. Mm-hmm. And around that point, I've been using a podcast since, but like around that point, I was listening to a bunch of podcasts, and that's when I came across, it was from WNBA Nation. It was actually on Candace Parker. It was like, mm-hmm. There was one on Candace Parker, and there's one on the Houston Comets that won like four titles at the beginning of the year.
Yeah. Yes. Like, they were the dynasty when I was a kid. Yeah.
They're both two part episodes, like, went in depth. And cause like at that point, like I would say me not following the WNBA wasn't more me saying it was bad quality. It was more, there was not a lot of coverage, I don't think.
And the visibility still just is not all the way there. It's getting better. Mm-hmm. It's way better than it was.
But. Yeah, more national televised games. Mm-hmm. But around that point, I was watching, and there was another one. It was like a ESPN 30 for 30 auto documentary. It was on like, I think it was on Sue Bird and Diana Taurasi playing overseas in Russia. And that experience, there was like some whole scandal over there. And I was like, wow. Like, I was like intrigued at that point. Mm-hmm. Didn't really do a lot with it. I watched a little bit of the playoffs. Then I got that was leading into the 2021 season. Followed a little bit more, and then once we got to like around this time last year, that's when I took it more seriously. And I was like, I like watching the NBA draft. I like covering these prospects, but I'm like, it's sort of oversaturated in a way where there's just so many people throwing out takes all over the internet.
Yeah.
And then I was like, why isn't nobody doing this for the WNBA? Like, mm-hmm. kind of set yourself apart.
Yeah.
So I was like, I kind of dabbled into it, started watching some film, and I was intrigued at that point. So that was, mm-hmm. I would say I had a lot of success in this first year, just, like, even with my board, like, I don't know if I can live up to what I did. I was too successful.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Starting with the hot hand. Yeah. So I watch WNBA when it's on. Like, it's not something that I have like a real in-depth knowledge of. And it's something I watch more casually. Like, I'm more just like, I'm watching this game and I'm cheering for the Chicago Sky because they are the local team and I would like them to win. Like, it's not something that I like really have a thorough understanding of. So what would you say in terms of style of play are the key differences between the WNBA and the NBA?
So I would say the NBA is more wing based when the WNBA mm-hmm. is more like forward post player based. Mm-hmm. We'll see more. I think like the WNBA is probably like 5-10 years behind the NBA, just like in terms of like scheme. Cause like, yeah, there's that, like, there's a buffer period because like we're seeing more like former coaches like Becky Hammon coming in. So like mm-hmm. some of the coaching concepts are transferring over, but I wouldn't say they're like identical right now. Just like there's still some teams that will run too many like unschemability players like that wouldn't otherwise be an NBA rotation.
Okay. Would you say though, like, even though it is like more post oriented, I feel like a lot of people get like a very like 90s idea in their head as far as like what that looks like. But would you say their like bigs are more skilled than that? Because like I feel like when I watch, and again, like this is going to be clouded because I just watch the sky a lot, but like with like Candace Parker and like on the championship team, like Stephanie Dolson was another player where like it felt like you could really trust them with the ball and they could do a lot as passers, where I felt like my idea of like big man centered basketball, like when I hear that, I picture more like men's Big Ten, like just dump it in there, back them down, and throw up a hook shot. Like, would you say that it's more like movement oriented around the post and things like that, or is it more just like, yeah, they just dump it in?
Yeah, it's a lot of ball movement. Like, I wouldn't say it's as helio. There's not as many heliocentric offenses. Like, there's probably very few. With the number of talent and just how many teams there is in the league, there's more like they have the advantage of just playing a lot of players. And what I've noticed with the WNBA, like they will just tend to like, I would say they wouldn't value young players as much as NBA teams do.
Yeah,
they stay more reliant to like, oh, this player is a good fit for our team, we'll just keep him around, instead of like looking more towards the future, because it's a lot more short term, like, because I guess most of them are like looking for their basketball opportunities beyond the WNBA. We're seeing more change now, I would say.
So yeah, because I think that's like a really interesting dynamic, is the fact that like this is a league where women's basketball is like really growing in popularity, and it's still a league that has 12 teams in it, so like roster spots are limited. So to your point, it's really easy for a team to be like, well, we have this girl who's like 24 or 23 and she's really developing, but we have this vet who's ready now, and like we've just got to win now. Like there's too many other teams that are playing other vets, so like we can't be the team that goes in on that strategy. So I want to transition that into talking about the draft in the WNBA. With there only being 12 teams, is it harder to play like a long-term tanking rebuild strategy when the best team in the league is picking 12th? You know what I mean? Like, cause it's one thing to be like, oh, we'll be really bad and we'll get good draft picks and we'll rebuild when like the best teams in the NBA have to pick at the end of the draft. But if the best team's picking 12th, that seems a lot harder. So like, is there a level of tanking, and like, has there been a team that's like really shot for a long-term rebuild? And if so, is it doable?
So they have a little bit of a different like draft lottery process, where like,
okay,
the draft order is based on the past two seasons, not just one.
Oh, okay.
So it's a different process. Cause like, I feel like what I did like this study where like, I think it's like almost every number one pick over the last like 15 years has ended up like yielding star level value.
Okay.
So like, the difference between, like you said, number one and number 12 is like it's like gigantic, that difference.
Okay.
Yeah, it's like unreal. You wouldn't expect that as much, because like we'll see like with the sky, like Emma Mieseman, I think she was like a second round pick. There's players like that will come in, but like if you have the number one pick, it's so hard to miss. So like teams are looking for that player, and I think it usually don't see it getting traded as much as it like you'd see in the NBA. How does that happen? I don't know. It's like, it's more number one is like standalone best player in the draft, I would say. So teams are trying to get that player, but tanking, I don't think tanking would be like,
it seems less viable if you're going off like a 2 year.
Yeah. It's kind of, they're just like naturally bad, I think. I think teams would just naturally be bad, because like overturning star talent, just it'll happen.
So like you said, like the number one pick generally is like pretty easy to hit on. What would you say is like the standard depth in a WNBA draft? Like, where do your tiers tend to break? Because I feel like with the NBA and like some drafts, it's like this one's like eight players deep, and this one's, you know, three players deep or whatever. Like, where did you find your cutoff point last year, as far as like, after this point, it starts to get a little dicey, and then after this point, like, you're just kind of scraping? Like, where did your tiers kind of fall as far as number of players in this past draft?
So I would say there wasn't any like generational talents in this past draft.
Mm-hmm.
But there was like there was a clear top three: Aaliyah Boston. No, not Aaliyah Boston. That was this year. Ryan Howard, Melissa Smith, and then Shakira Austin at the top.
Mm-hmm.
And then we saw it like break out into like a bunch of interesting archetypes. There was one player that was just like do it all forward. Another player that was more like small guard talent. Mm-hmm. There was like some like raw athletic player from like Spain. But like generally in the WNBA, there's like 12 players that end up like making an impact.
Okay,
it's around that number. It's like 9 and like 12 is like the main.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't it with the NBA? Generally, it's like 20, 25 players.
Yeah, yeah. I'd say in most drafts, it's right around there. Like when I make my board, like the big thing I try to ask myself is like, you're betting on 20 guys. Like the 20 that you put top 20 are the guys like that you really buy into. And then like the next five are like, what are the flyers you would take? Is like kind mm-hmm. of how I build my board. And then from there, it's just like, well, then how do you rank everybody else? Like that's my personal philosophy. But yeah, generally in most drafts, it's around 20 to 25.
Mm-hmm. So like what I saw with this year, like with my board, every player I had, like, cause I did a top 12, which is like who I consider to be like, okay, all of them ended up making a roster, which is like kind of rare. Cause like this past year, there was two players this past year that were first rounders that didn't make rosters
mm-hmm.
at a training camp. So every player did besides one, and that player stayed overseas. She probably would have made the roster if she did, if she didn't stay, but she came. She didn't come over, and she'll probably be over next year. So that's kind of like mm-hmm. an incomplete. The other 11 players didn't make in the roster. And
because I think that's something like people don't really anticipate. Because I have a good amount of friends that live in Australia, and this guy drafted an Australian or acquired an Australian player that was drafted.
Jade Melbourne.
Yeah, and then she was just like gone. Like she was on it. It felt like she was on the team for like a week and a half, and then that was it. So it is a lot more cutthroat. Do you attribute that just to like the lack of teams in the league and like there just aren't that many roster spots? So like if someone's not sticking, you've just got to keep moving and try to find the next best player. Like, or is it that kind of short-sightedness like you talked about, or is there like a bigger reason for that?
Because there ended up being a player that like. She was like older and she was like 23, coming on 24 out of UConn. She was drafted. I think you might be talking about her. She was drafted by Seattle. And then she ended up playing for like four teams in the span of like 4 months.
Mm-hmm.
She was a second round pick. So just like, yeah, that short-sighted mindset exists. Cause there's not a G League or anything. So
yeah. And like, there's not even a summer league, which mm-hmm. like that was the other thing I was going to ask about is like, what is, cause like, do the international seasons line up with the WNBA at all? Like, in terms of like when they play, or are they more like? Because I've always been under the impression that they play like around the time that the men here play, like more fall winter.
Yeah.
So let's say I'm like I'm a WNBA prospect. I go undrafted, or I don't make a team. Like, how easy is it to get back at that point? Like, is it just like you've just got to grind overseas? Is there a process? Do they have like showcase events, or is it just like you just got to grind?
I would say that most of those players will end up like staying in the States, then going overseas like in the fall.
Mm-hmm.
Because like the fall, I think it starts around like October and it goes to like May. So there's a little bit of an overlap area between training camp, and they're trying to cut down that, which makes no sense at all. Like trying to like add prioritization for some reason whenever those leagues are paying more, so it's like
it's hard. yeah,
so like I don't know, they can't really expect them to prioritize the league making them less money. So
mm-hmm.
like we'll see some players, but like more of the younger players though, like it's crazy because like Ryan Howard, she was a number one pick. She played this past season at Kentucky. She was drafted 2 weeks later, is at training camp, plays through the season. Then she goes to Team USA camp and plays with the main team. She didn't end up making the final roster, so she got like a 2 week break, and then now she's overseas in like Italy or something, and then that'll lead right to this training camp again. So it's crazy.
So it just to me, like as I look at the WNBA, it just doesn't seem smart just from like an investment standpoint to like have your players spinning their tires year round like that. Like it just to me, like it just feels like from a straight up business perspective, you'd be like, hey, this player was number one pick. Like, let's make sure they don't have to play really hard competitive basketball like year round with no breaks. Do you think, like, what do you think is next on the horizon for the WNBA on that front? Like, do you see, like, with the television ratings obviously being like really good the last couple of years, there is like visible substantial growth by just about every business metric. Do you see a point where like the salaries are going to get there, that like this type of thing won't be necessary, the players won't have to put themselves through this? Is expansion a viable option to get more people to buy into the league, and then that's a way that you can get more money? Like, how do you think the league is going to deal with this going forward?
So I think the midterm point in the CBA runs until 2025. So that's around the point where we're going to see like, there's so many issues to fix to the point where like not all of them are going to be able to get fixed. But I guess the hope is to have expansion teams by then, just because like if you have more teams, I guess that can like lead you having a larger deal, just having
more TV networks.
More TV networks in different cities across the country. So that's probably the next thing. And it's also getting like private flying. That's still crazy to me.
That's nuts. I don't understand that.
So like, yeah.
Yeah. So explain that to our listeners, because that was something I did not know about until like a couple years ago. And when I learned it, I was floored.
Yeah. So they fly commercial. And the weird thing about it is like, with flying commercial, like, it's not like your general, like, oh, if you're like 5'9", some of these girls are like 6'4", 6'5", and play a taxing 40-minute basketball game. And then you're right on the plane. And like, we saw a couple times, like, you probably know Aneka Ogumike. You probably know her. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So her, she's like the president. I think she's like the president of the, like Chris Paul is the president of the Player Association. Mm-hmm. Last season, they had a moment where they were on the road and they were flying back home to LA, and they got stuck at the airport, and they had to sleep at the airport overnight. And the team they were playing was in LA already. So they were the home team. They technically got to the arena later. They had to sleep in the hotel overnight because not all of them could get a hotel room. Man. And that's the president of the Players Association, like an MVP. It's great.
It's so wild. Cause yeah, like just from personal experience, like I'm 6'5", and like anytime I fly commercial, which is the only way I fly, cause I no ceilings, the money from no ceilings has not yet allowed me to acquire a private jet. I'm hoping by next draft cycle, hopefully. I've only flown commercial in my life, and every time I get off a flight, like I'm not a guy who's can afford first class. Like every time I get off a plane, the next like 2-3 days, my back is sore. Like I'm in really good shape. Like, but I get off a flight and like just from my knees being cramped into the seat in front of me, the posture that I have to assume to like be comfortable, I can't imagine if I was playing professional basketball. Like the idea of like, all right, go run around for an hour and a half, bang bodies with other people, do the rest of your like normal exercise routine that you have to do because you're a professional athlete and that's the expectation that is kept for you, and now get on a plane and now get off it and now go do that again and have another game. Like that is so draining. And the fact that like those are the circumstances that they have to do it under is again just one of those things where like, if you're just looking at this from an investment standpoint, taking all of the humanization out of this, just purely looking at it in the most cynical, like money-driven sense possible, it's bad. Like it's a bad, bad way to protect your product that you're putting on the court. And it's gonna make these players' lives miserable down the road, but it's gonna risk injury short term. Like there's just all these problems with it. And I'm pretty sure in the past too, haven't they had situations where games have been delayed or canceled just because like flights were canceled?
100%. And like just like you said, like just a human, just like they're humans, and like just like just treating them like professional athletes. Beyond that, it's like the player development opportunities, because like the league doesn't have their players in house, so like they don't have that same opportunity to like summer league where they can like have specific they have their team trainers, but instead they're playing on a different team. Mm-hmm. Just like different team over the entire season, over the entire off season. There's this like league called Athletes Unlimited. It's like,
yes. Yeah. I've heard of it.
Yeah. So that's like similar. And like, I hope they can like expand that more where they can use that as like more of a player development opportunity. But like, as of right now, it's more like February ish area. It's like, it's like a specific city, like similar to like OTE, where they're at a specific location.
Yeah, like they're just out of Atlanta with OTE. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like that, but they like, it's weird because it's like, it's individual points. It's a weird like standing.
It's like
system.
Fantasy basketball, but real, right? Where it's like,
yeah,
there's like points every week. And then if you get the most points, I think you're like the captain of your team the following week or something like that.
Yeah, so we're seeing like, they're like trying to be innovative, but it's like, it sucks because like, this isn't the WNBA trying to make change. It's like outside sources trying to like help provide other opportunities, which is horrible. Just like, it just makes them look unserious because they're not like,
it does. Yeah.
It's, that's the main thing I think everybody's just like hoping for is just like, that's why they can't expand to Toronto yet, because there's not, they mm-hmm. can't fly like commercial into Toronto. Like they have to go private. That's like, that's too much. Like,
yeah. And like, you just look at it, like how Canada like rallied around the Raptors during their title run. It's like, don't you think that'd be great for the WNBA?
They have so many women's
basketball
fans.
Same thing?
They have so many fans there. Yeah. Just with Team Canada.
Yeah. I mean, it just feels like they're leaving money on the table just like for a short-term focus that it doesn't even really make sense on a short-term basis. Do want to apologize. You are going to hear my daughter making her appearance in the background. Hopefully a future huge fan of the NBA and WNBA. So the next thing I wanted to ask you is with scouting, what would you say are the biggest differences when you're evaluating players for the NBA and WNBA? Like, is there something specifically different that you're looking for or anything like that?
I wouldn't say they're not that different. You kind of have to place yourself in a different mindset where like I'm more like, if there's a 5'5" guard, like there's a better chance that could actually work out instead of in the NBA, where it's like how I look at it is like, if you're 5'5", a good basis of comparison is like adding 5 inches. So like,
okay,
a 5'5" guard in the WNBA is like equivalent to like 5'10".
Yeah, so that which kind of thing for like, us, we're generally just like, 5'10", no thanks.
Yeah, that can work. Like, there's someone in this class that's 5'5", like, dribble, pass, shoot type. It can work. There's some players like that have been, like, key contributors on a championship team. Like, difference is, like, a lot of the stuff is similar, I would say. I would just, like, I don't think there's as many, like, rookies that will come in and, like, be granted, like, a lot of opportunities as scorers. You have to consider you have to consider who can play off ball, because like there's a bunch of players that are like 6'4", like post players in college, and they're like their offense is completely built around their team, and like the post-up's kind of like getting like filtered out. I would feel like it's starting to slowly, where it's like it's only good offense for like the best of the best, like that type of things. Like, it's mm-hmm. not even good offense anymore. And like, if they do play, it's like 5-10 minute spurts. Or like a Luka Garza, like those types. Like, some comparisons there. Like, so I wouldn't say it's like a totally different thing. You just have to look at it in a different perspective, where like, in the eyes of teams, they're not going to be as willing to take a lot of bets on players and as many risks.
That makes sense too. Yeah. Especially because like you were talking how there's not a ton of player development opportunity. It wouldn't really make sense to use your pick, especially if it's like a higher one, on somebody that's like really raw or toolsy. Like, you wouldn't see like a Poku or an Usman Jang type.
There actually was one taken number 2 overall.
Oh really?
Her name's Awak Queer. Yeah. So she was drafted by Dallas in like 2021. Mm-hmm. Super raw, like kind of the mold of Poku. Like, she was like 19 from like, She was from overseas, and like mm-hmm. 2 years in, and she's like provided like no impact at all. Like, hasn't got a lot of minutes either. So it's like, she's actually got like a chance to stay. But like, if it's like after like generally, if you're a first round pick, you're probably going to get at least 1 year on a team. Mm-hmm. Like, if you're raw, like we consider like after like 20, like that's like the cutoff point. There's still teams rostering like upside swing type prospects, like second round, like we saw JT Thor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
those type of players, like JT Thor, wouldn't stick like even a year in the league in the WNBA. Like, they would mm-hmm. they'd go to training camp, and they'd probably like get cut early on, or like if they do make the roster, they'd probably play a couple games and they get cut. and then they go overseas and they try to like get back in. Like we saw Rebecca Gardner, like with this guy, she was like 32 and she just came over for the first time ever. It's hard to get in and stick ultimately.
Do you think that's like a problem for the league, or do you think it's just like, that's just how it is? Like, you've just got to be really good or else it's just not the time. Like, maybe you just come later. Like, do you think it would be better for the league if they found a way to like invest more in player development locally?
Versus exporting that
overseas and making players develop elsewhere.
Yeah, they need to adopt like some like developmental like opportunities, because there's only 12 roster spots. It's not the NBA where there's 15, so like you're already short 3 spots. So I would just say like if they add two teams. Per team, then you have like, how many more players is that? It's like 30, 40 more players. And then if you kind of partner with like the Athletes Unlimited thing I was saying, where you have like more opportunities for players like that aren't like in the league at the moment, like players that were like maybe high draft picks that like haven't had a chance to showcase themselves, like that type of thing. I just don't think there's like you said, players can just get filtered out so easily, and you're just like, where do they go?
Well, it's one of those things too, where you wonder like, is again, like, it's just a question of like purely from an investment standpoint, like, is that the best thing? Like, would it be better for our league long term if we were able to keep more players under our auspices, like within our buildings and like with high level player development, and like not having to force them to like go overseas, deal with culture shock, deal with like getting used to playing in another country, like being somewhere where you don't speak the language, like it's a lot to throw on players to be like, do that and then like come back to us. Like, would it really be better to just have them?
That would probably be better, but like we're probably like 10 years out from that, I would say, like generally from like, because like right now there's some players that don't go overseas, like Asia Wilson, Kelsey Plum, Candace Parker doesn't go overseas anymore. Like there's good players like Skylar Diggins Smith, like Aguma Kays, they don't go overseas. But most of those players I just mentioned, like they have like big deals. Like, they're
very famous players.
Yeah, just for the average player though, they're probably going overseas and making money, and just like we'll see some of them like go overseas and like average like 25 points in like the EuroLeague. It's kind of crazy. Just like opportunities overseas can give them So it's like that's really their chance to like be a star overseas.
So when the next WNBA draft is like coming up really soon, right?
No, it's not until like April.
Why did I think it was in November? I feel like somebody said, I don't know. For some reason, I thought it was in November. That's my bad. So it's in April. Yeah, so it's like
lottery.
Okay. That's what it is. So who are some of the players that you're monitoring, like going to this college season, that obviously at the draft, not for a while, but like who are some of the players that you're excited about and keeping an eye on headed into this WNBA draft cycle?
So Aaliyah Boston, that's probably the biggest name, more traditional post. Like,
and who does she play for currently?
South Carolina. She's at South Carolina. Kind of does a little bit of everything, like kind of like the DeAndre Ayton type, I would say. Like,
okay.
Yeah. So she's kind of like in that type of player, just like strong physical, super, super ready to play. And there's also like Haley Jones. I wrote an article on her. She's kind of like Scottie Barnes. Like,
okay.
Yeah. So she's like the tough thing about her and scouting her is she plays at Stanford and they have like some Princeton offense, which is like, there's not a lot of freedom in that. So like a lot of her creation flashes, like improvising will come in like the open court, where she makes so many like smart decisions. Like she's like 6'2", like strong lower body. And then after that, there's some other like talented forwards, like Diamond Miller. She's like, who would I compare her to? Let's see. I'll come back to her. There's like JC Sheldon. She's like a rim pressure guard. She just like gets to the rim with ease, like at Ohio State. Like there's other guards like that are just like dribble, pass, shoot, where they're providing a lot of value in terms of their rim pressure and also their shooting ability. But like back with like, there's a lot of forwards. Like I said, like there's not a lot of opportunities for these like raw players. There's a lot of those in this class.
Okay.
So it's kind of a learning moment for me. I want to, I'm there's one, like, I mentioned to you in, like, over.
Yeah.
Tommy here, she plays at South Carolina as well. She's like 6'4 ball handler. And I'm like way too high on her. So, like,
that's good. That's good to have, like, your players that you're really into.
So, like, I have her like around like number 8 or something like that. And like, she's like super raw. Like, she averaged like 6 points in college last year. Like, it's like the idea of her game is amazing. And I'm just trying to see, like, I want to learn from her and like just see, like, is it viable to like kind of project these players like beyond like the top 5, these raw players? Can they actually like advance their game and be in the lead? Just because, like, you think like, oh, 6'4", she can handle the ball, she can defend on the perimeter. Like, if you think, you're like, oh yeah, that's a professional player. That player can probably play at the highest level. So, like, another player is Jordan Horston. She's at Tennessee. It does a lot of similar things, but she's a lot more productive.
Okay.
So she'll probably make a roster. Like, I would expect her to make a roster. So it's like, if you're trying to find those 12 players, you have to see, for one, who's going to be a fit with, like, the teams. Like, is there a team that already has a player at their position? Because that could cause them not to make the opening roster. Then there's also, like, they're raw, and if they're not ready enough, like, teams like, I don't want to roster someone that can't play for us. Then we're down to 11 players. Then if someone's hurt, you're at 10. So it's like, you don't have a lot of freedom to like throw someone at your 15th.
Yeah.
First on the bench. So
would you say that there is anything that is like a guaranteed thing that, like, you know, scales well, like generally, like with basketball, like steals, like rebounds, like that kind of stuff, like scales really well. Is there anything like, in terms of like the women's college game to the WNBA, that you're like, well, if this person's really productive in college, they will be really productive in the WNBA. Like, where's been like the disconnect? Like, who are the types of players that might be really good in college but don't pan out in the WNBA?
So, like I said earlier, it's like the players that are like post creators. Just like players that don't have a lot of scheme ability. I would say those players don't have as easy of an opportunity to make teams and stick in the league. Beyond that, though, like, there's some guard talent that just, like, they're just inefficient. I would just say,
okay,
yeah, there's like there can kind of be some things where, like, they're like big time scorers in college, and then like that's like their main skill is just scoring, and like the combo guard type skill set, like, they can kind of get filtered out as well. Like, so those are two skill sets where, like, you think about it, those two skill sets are like, they also get filtered out in the NBA. We're seeing like combo guards, like, some of those players won't stick as long as other positions.
Yeah. It's funny that you mentioned scoring too, because, like, I had a conversation with a college assistant a while ago who coaches in like a bigger Division I men's conference, and like, he was talking about transfer ups, and his team has used the portal quite a bit. And what he told me was, he was like, we know, like, this translates up and this doesn't. And he's like, with scoring, it's like a roll of the dice. Like, he's like, we just don't know. And it's true. Like, I think for a lot of times, like, if scoring is your thing and you're not like a really great advantage creator, or you're not really savvy about how you can leverage your playmaking, or you're not a good enough athlete or polished enough with your footwork to like know that you can get those shots, it can get really tricky. Like, if your thing is just, I score the basketball.
So yeah, that's a good point there. So there's not a ton of differences. Like, if you someone just started watching college process, you can kind of tell who's a prospect and who's not. It's like, it's very clear who is a prospect, I would say. Like,
okay.
Yeah. So there's not like that middle area where, like, if they're a first round pick, more than likely they're a prospect. It's just a matter of like where they fit between skill, like upside and stability. Like, they're more on the upside. If they're more on the upside, they have to be a high draft pick or be on a team when like Indiana has, like, they rostered like 5 rookies last year. Just like,
okay. Yeah. That's interesting. I think it's interesting to think about as far as just the different philosophies, because, like, at the same time, it's like, yeah, it is more clear cut, But at the same time, like, the penalty for missing feels so much greater, where it's like, if you miss on one of those players and, like, you know, like, there's only 12 of them, like, it's like whiffing in the lottery, basically, like, if you don't kind of hit on your first round pick then, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, man, that's tough. Well, I'm really glad that you came on here and you kind of educated me and our audience about this, because I think it's really fascinating. And like you said, like, there's just not a lot of WNBA draft coverage, and this is a league that's becoming more popular and it's growing. So I just really wanted to have you come on here, tell us about it, and kind of pick your brain and learn more about it. So thanks again, Hunter. I'm going to have you plug your stuff one more time before we head on out.
So I'm on Twitter at HunterCruz14. All my stuff's there, but yeah, so that's where you'll find a lot of my work. And then, like, Locked On Wins Basketball on YouTube, podcasting platforms, just a lot of stuff there weekly. Kind of like y'all are doing No Ceilings, but, like, on the WNBA scale, where
that
type of stuff.
Awesome. Well, we'll keep a lookout for it. We're really glad you could join us, man. Like, we're here at No Ceilings, like, you're somebody that we really respect, and, like, we really love to check out your work. So that's what Home and Away is all about. We're trying to get some people from the outside that we really like and bring them on for a show here. So I really appreciate you taking the time. I appreciate all of our listeners for tuning into this one. And stay tuned. Make sure you're subscribed to the feed. Also rate and review on your podcast app of choice. And we'll see you guys tomorrow with more content on the No Ceilings NBA podcast feed. Have a great day.